This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
My name's Mark O'Neill. I'm the Principal Advisor to the Director Indigenous here at the National Museum and a curator. But it's my pleasure today to introduce you to these two historic creative types. And they'll expose themselves during the afternoon. One, not the other way, the right way. And this is part of a historical imagination series that the museum run. And the running order for today is that I'll introduce the event as I'm doing, and then Sam Wagon Watson, sitting over there, will the poet. We'll conduct a short poetry reading for about 5 minutes, and then Peter will read from one of his works for about 5 minutes, and then Sam will discuss how historical research informs his poetry for about 15 or so. We won't be too kind of Gestapo-ish about the time. And Peter discusses how imagination informs his research work, and then we'll have an open discussion with questions from you fellas, and we'll all have a conversation. You know, it won't be them and us. We'll kind of gather it all together and exchange views and opinions. And the fact that you're here means you're obviously very interested in the concept and the peoples, and we're really lucky to have these two people here. And the whole, it's really based on the whole idea of, you know, how writers use history to inspire their works of fiction, and of course the converse is how writers use literary devices to history writers to create and inspire history writing. And this day and age, of course, you know, you just have to think of the Da Vinci Code, you know, as an almost too predictable example to mention. But, you know, those kinds of things, it's very much this fluidity between disciplines, and particularly this idea of a blurring of boundaries. And we all know that, you know, history is a bit of a fiction anyway, so we're kind of all in the same ballpark from diverse quarters. So the whole idea of fact, fiction, history, poetry is all very much a topic that, you know, creative minds like to ponder on these days. And the flow between is creates really fascinating stories and concepts. So what this is being recorded because it's part of a series. So when we do get to talking time, I know it's inconvenient to have one of those microphones in your face, but it's really important to sort of record all this, being a museum and history and archiving. So we'll record the series. So it probably wouldn't hurt to introduce yourself. First of all, I'll just introduce Peter. And I'm sure most of you or many of you know who Peter is, because he's well known about town and about the country, actually. He's a very well-known historian. Currently he's at the University of Sydney. He spent most of his professional life writing and researching in two areas: the significance of Australian place and Aboriginal history, especially the history of the Stolen Generations. And those who know, in about 1980 he was a co-founding member of LinkUp in New South Wales, which is the organisation that helps to return people who were separated from their communities when they were children. And it's sort of a life mission, and there's hundreds of us who thousands of us who have benefited, and families who have benefited from his work and the work of all the others who have since stepped into the fold. His books include Charles Perkins, a biography, Returning to Nothing, Belonging, and A Rape of the Soul So Profound, and The Return of the Stolen Generations. He's just completed work, I'm sure, work on Joy Williams, who's, I'm sure you'll have occasion to talk about that fascinating story. And the thing about Peter and I think links both these fellows, but the thing about Peter that really I'm really grateful for, probably, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for, is this concept of this idea of looking at the urban Aboriginal situation urban Aboriginal people as a sort of a not this, it's outside the scope of, we're not culturalist outcasts who have a diminished, like a culture of loss, is actually very clearly defined the whole history of urban dwellers, and that's a contentious as well, but as a continuing and adapting culture rather than one that has been diminished in any way. And similarly, Sam was at a, both of them actually were at a forum we held here some months ago called Who You Calling Urban, which accompanies the 70% Urban exhibition down there, which you'll get to see if you haven't already. And that's very much about the idea that 70% of Indigenous people live in, at least 70% live in urban environments. So an urban existence has a very strong and dynamic culture, exists very diverse. Culture exists for us, and one of the speakers, Anita Heiss, actually, her paper was called Concrete Couriers and Westfield Dreaming. So it's very much about defining who we are rather than defining who we're not, which is usually not us defining that situation, usually others who remind us. So it's a really fantastic kind of movement at the moment, this sort of giving validity to the urban Indigenous experience, and both Samuel and Peter focus a lot on that one way or another in very diverse ways. So I'll introduce Sam when he's opportunity to get up and speak. So in the interim, I think we'll invite Peter to conduct a short reading for you. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks very much, Margot. Well, my reading is from a book. I've just finished the draft of it. It's a biography of Joy Williams. She was a Wiradjuri woman who was taken away from her family at a very young age, as was her mother, Doretta, and she sued the state for wrongful removal, and after about a 10-year series of court cases, finally lost everything. And I'm writing this for various reasons as a kind of scenes from her life. Each scene is about, I don't know, what, 15, 20 pages or so. And this one is to do with her mother, Doretta, when she was about 30, and she'd gone down to the Bomaderry Children's Home to try and see her daughter Joy, which she used to see because she found out where Joy was. Born in Crown Street 4 years before that, in 1942. This is set in 1946. And the learned judge in Joy's court case found, in the absence of any evidence one way or the other, I find that Doretta had given up Joy voluntarily for adoption. This scene of mine presents the opposite point of view, as you'll see, in which Doretta is told in no uncertain terms that your daughter is being removed from Bomaderry, which is only a baby's home, and she's going to be sent to Lutanda, which is a Plymouth Brethren home at that time in the Blue Mountains. So that's where the scene is. Doretta sitting with Joy in a little bench down at Bomaderry, which is near Nowra, and sister comes out and says, I want to see you. Doretta, you may have a few minutes with Joy, and then I'd like you to come in the office, please. Yes, Sister Ellen. Doretta and Joy were sitting side by side in the shade of the wooden bench at the Aboriginal Inland Mission for infants at Bomaderry. Doretta wore her best blue cotton dress with a shiny buckle and looked down at her daughter Joy. I've got to go and see Sister Joy. Joy's eyes looked myopically up at her. Why? I don't know. I'll be back in a minute. Doretta climbed the three creaky stairs to enter the long wooden hut whose eastern end formed Sister's office. Her desk faced the door. Behind her, a window formed part of the end of the hut, and above that, a picture of Jesus and the words, Jesus loves all the children of the world. Now, Sister Ellen was sitting in a hard, upright wooden chair behind her wooden office desk. Two chairs stood opposite. She smiled at Doretta as she stood framed hesitantly in the door. Doretta, sit down. Sister tried to catch her eye, but Doretta pursed herself sideways to allow herself to see Joy playing in the gravel. In her tartan skirt and blue cardigan, her daughter, age 4, was making patterns in the gravel with her toe. Abruptly, without a backward glance, she rose and skipped out of sight beyond the long wooden dormitory. Doretta returned her eyes to the seat and the pattern. "I'm glad you came today, Doretta. I wanted to see you." Doretta made no reply to this unexpected beginning. Her eyes didn't move from the pattern. "We don't like the mothers of our babies coming here. I told you that last time you were here. It was most unfortunate that Mrs. Ingram told you that Joy was here, but in a way, it was a good thing, because we have a problem with Joy." Doretta turned her dark eyes from the open door to Sister's hands holding some papers on a desk. "We don't have room for her at Bomader any longer." Doretta raised her eyes to Matron's face to squint at her head silhouetted in front of the blaze of light. Her body froze. Surely Sister was not going to allow her to have her daughter back. "Now, Joy's a dear little girl, and we love her very much, especially Sister Leela. She's become Joy's special mummy. We try and let all our babies have a special mummy in their lives. But there are just too many children here, Doretta. There are two new babies coming in just this week. We've grown to love your little girl, Doretta. She's been very happy here in seeking the Lord. In God's care, she's been very happy here, but we have to send her away." Matron looked at Doretta inquiringly. Thinking a response was expected, Doretta gave a tiny shrug. "And you want the best for her, don't you?" Doretta made an almost imperceptible nod. No, it wasn't possible. It wasn't possible. She wasn't going to get Joy back. She dropped her eyes to the floor. "Now, most of our babies usually go off to Cootamundra. That's where you were too, wasn't it, Doretta? But Joy is really too young to go there. So we're going to send her to another home, just for white children. She'll be much better off there." Doretta's eyes remained fixed to the floor. "It'll be the best for her. It's a good Christian home. With God's richest blessing, she'll come to know the Lord Jesus as a personal saviour." Doretta's eyes didn't shift. In her chair, she was of stone. "Joy is already very attentive to the wishes of the Lord." Still, Doretta said nothing, but moved her head to allow herself to hold the gravel pattern in her gaze. Sister, a little unsettled by her seeming impassivity, removed her glasses to eye the Aboriginal woman. "So what I need for you to do is sign this form here, which will allow Joy to be sent there." Without moving her head, Doretta almost had to glance sideways at the small printed form. "I'll fill in the details for you later. You'll have to sign it there." She indicated the paper with one arm of the glasses. "Just sign there. What you have to do is sign this form down the bottom there. Here's the pen." And more encouragingly, "This means that Joy can continue to fill God's plan for her." Doretta dipped her pen in the inkwell and signed below the point of Matron's glasses. "Good. Now you can be happy and know that Joy is going off to a better life in a good Christian home. She often says she loves the Lord. She often surprises us with her questions. She's so grown up." Silence. "And you see, she does look out of place amongst all these dark babies here." And seemingly as an afterthought, "We call our babies our treasures in earthen vessels." A pause in which a wail of the baby, a baby, echoed through the fibro wall of Sister's office. "Is there anything you'd like to know?" A pause. For the first time in several minutes, Doretta raised her head. In a continuous movement, her eyes traversed the table, the dazzling silhouette of Sister's head, the open door, the splintery floor, and stopped on her own bright, shiny buckle. Without looking up, she asked, "Will I be able to see Eileen there?" "What's that, dear?" "Will I be able to see her where she's going?" "No, no, no, no." And more kindly, "No, probably it's best that you don't, dear. By giving Eileen a Joy for us to look after, you've been doing the Lord's work for us, and I don't want you to spoil it all now by going up there all the time. You'll only upset her. That would be really selfish of you. You see, she's got her own mother now, that's Sister Leela, and Sister will be going there to see Joy from time to time in the place we're going to send her. She's very fond of her. You needn't worry about that. You may hold your daughter in your heart, but it's best for you keep away from her for a long time. She'll be leaving here at the end of the week." Through the fibro wall of Matron's office, the baby was crying again. Doretta watched Sister put the form in a folder marked in black, Eileen Joy Williams, and close it. "So, now I'm getting Mr. Mack to take you in the truck back up to Wallaga Lake. You can wait outside until he comes. You're going back there, aren't you?" Almost imperceptibly, Doretta nodded. She kept her eyes turned from sister's questioning gaze. Now, I've rung up Mr. Tucker to make sure you don't come back here, the manager. There's really no use trying to see her anymore because she won't be here. You understand that, don't you, Doretta? You must keep away from her from now on. Unable to catch Doretta's eye, matron pointed out towards the gravel. Well, if you wait out there, Mr. Mack will be along in a minute to pick you up. Goodbye, Doretta. And Doretta descended the creaky steps to the seat and to the pattern.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. Certainly a more insightful way of learning about the history of individual lives through that kind of dialogue and recreating the situation, which Peter does so well in lots of his readings. And, of course, there's a very performative aspect to Peter's history telling, and we're talking about history being accessible to people. This is certainly, I think he's one of the leaders in that way of proceeding. Now, I know I've reversed the order. It should have been Sam up first, but we're not going to stand on ceremony here. So, Sam, I'd like to introduce you to Samuel Wagan Watson. He is the winner of the 1999 David Yonipan Award for his volume of poetry, Muse, Meandering and Midnight. It was published as part of the University of Queensland publishing Black Australian Writer Series. Samuel Wagan Watson was born in Brisbane in 1972. Like the rest of us, he's a Bitzer. He's an Irish, German, Bundjalung and Birragubba, and probably a whole heap more. And in 2000, which makes him very special, in 2005, Sam participated in the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, winning the Premier's Book of the Year Award and the Kenneth Slessor Prize for Poetry for his 2004 collection, Smoke Encrypted Whispers. Now, you know, as Indigenous people, we're very proud of people like Sam and others of our writers, and many of us are writers and artists, because it's one of the few ways that we actually could get any kind of Indigenous agency or political voice. So he's has a lot to say in a lot of places. He gets around to lots of places, does gigs all over the place, and he was just telling me about how he's doing some writing now for the Japanese. So his work is valued, highly valued by lots of people inside and outside this country. So I'd like to introduce you to Samuel Wagan Watson.
No, thank you, Margot, and thank you, Peter, and thank you to you all. It's a pleasure to be back here in Canberra once again. The poetry I'll read, I'll later relate to back to in my talk, but very special to be here on this spot, which is, I suppose, the memories of both my Indigenous ancestry and my European ancestry in one building is equal, where it's not equal anywhere else in this country, unfortunately. But even though I do get around, I am proudly Australian. Whenever I go overseas, I try to be as diplomatic as I can for the current father of our country, Uncle Johnny. But the most important thing about being an Indigenous writer is that I live within, I suppose, a recent... when other countries talk about their history, Australia, there's still several generations of both my European and Indigenous side that are still living in recent history. The recent history of our country. What makes my job so important, I think, is the fact that I do have a chance to help shape in my writing the identity of this country, and that's what I try to say to kids every day. We're a young country, and what you write and your creativity can help make a greater identity. So I will start with this poem, Midnight's Boxer. And it's set in Brisbane, and it's about... It's based on several of my uncles who made their teeth as young men in the Jimmy Sharman's boxing tents. Midnight's Boxer. Midnight's boxer he has become, that the ghosts from the tents of long ago pay homage. Memories that fill a boarding house room, and busted knuckles soothe endlessly with goanna oil, and on the soul scars that can't. stories in his eyes, he could have been an Olympian. But try and extract the truth from his fists, although he wouldn't know how to sink in the boot, a tender honour picked up off the battlefields of assimilation. Midnight's boxer, he has become a 57-year-old gas tank that can't see empty, blackened skin like blackening memory, and hard, plain hard. The unrecognised pillar of his mob, and after midnight is gone, way gone, and his time is over, will he then only be missed and his triumphs mentioned? Midnight's boxer he has become. And this poem here, it's set in West End on Boundary Street. It's called Last Exit to Brisbane. Boundary Street, that forged black scratch, a vein from South Bank to West End with a tail swallowed by the Chocolate River. This is the line, the limit, where the dark skin were told, do not cross. A fence raised to protect the colonial domiciles of angels and gadflies. And even today at rush hour, that tar permanently keeps the scar alive and the dead languages buried, to only escape in the bitumen heat haze and fall upon deaf ears as this boundary continues to stay true to its makers. Denying the junkyard dingo the treasures of the city and no access to Easy Street, fringe dwelling in white light static on the last exit to Brisbane. I said I'll relate back to these poems in my talk. I've tried to do the sunsets and butterflies thing with my writing. Unfortunately, the sunsets and butterflies stuff doesn't get published, but what I do try to create are small textual postcards, and what gets published are glimpses of my history and history that I've grown up with. And this poem here especially is about a place that's totally forgotten in Brisbane, yet millions of people pass through it every day, Crib Island. For a while, Dad worked in a ghost town. He'd take us there on weekends after the government moved an entire community, empty building after empty building, like some big science fiction film set. Wandering through deserted houses, we were the first Aboriginal people to analyse the remains of the first Europeans to be cleared from this soil. Street strewn with all sorts of treasures, Armageddon and its apocalyptic merchandising. Earth-moving equipment droning in the distance, always closing in, and the birds, dark wings scuttled from silent twisters of smouldering debris and detritus, doorways whistling breezes, a cadence of toothless old skeletons that filled the smoke-encrypted whispers of this mass grave. I think about those whispers every time my plane takes off or lands on the unmarked tombstones of one of Brisbane's least known burial grounds. On deserted streets, forgotten newspapers dance. Dust keeps its appeal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Though you can see he's a great reader of his own poetry, and a lot of poets aren't. So it's very emotive and very. I wouldn't tell them. No, I say this to all of them that come here. See. first time I've done this. So, but you can see it's very much a lived experience. Thus, the power, the words. And therefore the history. And I think one of the other important things to say about what Sam and Peter do is, I think they're making it clear, and particularly with what Sam was just saying, is the concept of a shared history. I think we've, the enlightened ones have moved past this bipartite sort of, segregate. We are all Australian, we all have a history and we share each other's history. And I think that's something that's, despite our father figure mentioned earlier, that's kind of what is happening in this country, particularly amongst our young Indigenous people and our creative people. This concept of it's not them, us, and anything you've got, we haven't got, vice versa, which, as we know, is a human condition. But for those who are open and willing will be starting to receive the messages that we're talking about, a shared history. You know, as ordinary as that may sound, it seems to be a very difficult concept, and certainly the museum's very much into that, as you will see in the gallery of First Australians and throughout the whole museum. Now I'd like to ask Peter if he would discuss how imagination informs his research work.
Well, as Margot says, I'm a historian using a variety of ways which I think are appropriate to write my histories. And right the other way around. And I thought I'd change gear a little bit and talk about some other work I've done. Although I always work with people, have all my life. I don't call myself an oral historian because I use every kind of records that there are, of which history, talking to people, is absolutely essential part. Every book I've ever written, with my book on Charlie Perkins, I think there was about 100 people I interviewed for that. And my books, three books on place, have all got, I don't know how many people there are in each of them, but I really take the view that you can't understand anything about contemporary society or anything that happened 30 years ago unless we go and talk to people about their views and what they think happened. I've got no sympathy whatsoever with the debate about whether oral history is real or not, or if it makes mistakes or not, and so on. I won't go into that now. Partly because a lot of what I'm ascertaining is what people think, what their feelings are about certain events, and obviously that's got a validity simply because it's what they think at a certain time. So let's think about the way I wrote about the destruction of Adam Enderby in my book Returning to Nothing, which is a book about the destruction of places and how we feel about places which we've lost. And there's half a chapter on Adam Enderby, which you'll know in 1957 was flooded by what became Lake what? I used to call it Lake Adam Enderby. I think it's called something else now. Like what? Lake Eucombeen, that's right. The initial name was Lake Adam Enderby, and that was interesting that the Snowy wanted to get rid of that name, and I didn't want to remind people of the town that had been there. Okay, well, the three things that I use there are obviously the official documents, because people's reminiscences, often they can't even tell you what year it happened in, let alone when, or how big the lake is, or why it was done in the first place, which obviously is really important. My readers will want to know why the Snowy scheme was happening at all. And not everybody understands that, who was a victim of that, and they might have forgotten and they might have different ideas about it. But obviously readers need to know what the official story is. So of course I go to the official documents. But then the real meat of any of the work I do starts, which is talking to people. And I suppose I would have spoken to maybe 10 or 12 families who'd been involved in the inundation of Adam Enderby when I was working there about 15 years ago, I suppose. About half of them still live in what used to be called New Adam Enderby, just called Adam Enderby now, and some live in Coomera and some live in Canberra, because some after the inundation went away and never came back. Now, the reason I like talking to people is I'm a natural moral historian, I suppose. Never happier than when I'm yarning with people. But also because that gives you that wonderful grasp of detail, which I can incorporate. And generally speaking, under the names, almost always under the names of the people who tell me these things. For instance, some of the themes people were talking about at Adam Enderby, some were expected, some were a little bit unexpected. One of them was the town we used to have, the town we used to know. People would say, well, we had six pubs going flat out here. And the Saturday nights, the three huge general stores were open until 6 o'clock in the evening. And people from the surrounding station would drive a 2-ton truck into town to fill up, get their supplies for the next 2 months and drive away again. And it was such a happy little town. Everyone had half an acre and they had their cow and their goat. And we'd go down to the picnic races. And it was a fantastic time. You might think it was a bit nostalgic, over-romantic. Yeah, maybe it was, but that's not the point. I'm not trying to make a judgment on whether their views of the town is romantic or not. That's not my view to say that, certainly not in a book like this, but I'm trying to ascertain what people felt about the destruction of the town. So quite a lot of generalised information, generalised emotion about the town we used to have here. Much more precise was when I began to ask people, what did you leave behind there? I didn't think that would be a particularly relevant question in the beginning, but I realised people want to talk about that. That was interesting, because in the 50s there's a real sort of push for modernism. So people leaving the old town for the new, not only were they hooked into the snowy propaganda, which was you're being selfish if you get in the way of progress, because this is a great work for Australian engineering, but also you've got to leave all that old stuff behind. When you move to New Adderby, you're going to have running water. You're going to have electricity. So you can get rid of your old kerosene lamps and your hurricane lamps. And you can get rid of all the water pitchers and the old tin bath you have to have a bath with in front of the in the lounge room every Saturday night, because we're going to a place where there'll be lots of these new amenities. There's a sort of hint of modernism there which is driving people. And so a lady called Mrs. Nita Stewart told me, well, our mum told us, take that big camp oven, throw it in the well. All those pictures on the wall there, throw them in the well as well. Nita was asking herself, she's only at 12 at the time, what are we doing that for? We realise now, she said, that mum was in a state of grief. She didn't know it at the time. She wanted to destroy these things because she said, well, her excuse was, well, we can't take them with us. Then she said, and the pictures went down, they looked down there, and the saucers went down there, and things in the cow yard went down there. All sorts of things we thought we wanted, even in the new town, we threw away. And people still talk very nostalgically now about the wagons they left behind. And one or two motor cars got left behind. And conversely, how they dug the roses out of the garden, took them to the new town. They dug the bulbs out, daffodil bulbs, irises, and planted them in the new town as a kind of continuity. Everyone wanted to talk to me about the things they left behind or the things they carried with them. And such precise details, all of which I was able to incorporate into the new chapter on Adaminaby, partly because it reflected people's emotions and partly because it gives the text a lot of life, having these particular and precise details. And when they got to the new town, people's memories became quite clear. It's hard to believe that even if your house, wooden house, came with you to the new town on the back of a big trailer, you didn't necessarily regard it as your house anymore. If you had a three-bedroom house and your two teenagers' kids had just left, you were given another house. And even if you got the same house, it was on new stumps. It had been re-stumped. It faced in a new direction. Your neighbours were different. People remember that so clearly. Look out the window. They shouldn't be there. The chimney, which never used to smoke when the wind was from the southeast, now began to smoke. The windows wouldn't open and shut anymore. When you walked past the second bedroom and stood on a certain plank, the door would spring open. Everything was different. When somebody asked for a new back door, the authority gave them a door off the chook yard. When she complained, she was told, aren't you ever satisfied? Seems extraordinary, the callousness, cruelty of the Snowy Mountains Authority. But people weren't going on to me about the Snowy Mountains Authority cruelty. If you like, that's my role, to interpret it. People were giving me these such precise details of what they were talking about. And when they talked about the new town, such precise details again. Or such colourful language. You could fire a rifle up the main street on Saturday morning, never hit a soul, I was told. It's colourful language, you know. So that's an example of the colourful language, the deep emotional response which people are bringing, which I'm trying to incorporate. In the book I was just reading out just now, which I've just finished the draft of, that's just about one individual. Generally speaking, I'm working with a lot of people. Now, my role, if I want to be an oral historian, I just gather those things up, call the book Adaminaby and run a series of interviews. But, you know, I'm a historian, not just an oral historian, reproducing other people's texts, though I do that as well. So my role is, first of all, I'm sure Sam will agree with this, we writers, you've got to put an imaginative ring around it and say, right, that's what I want to write about. That's the experience of human beings in this particular place at this time. So our duty is to grasp that imaginatively and see it as something we can write about. It's kind of obvious when you describe it as that, but it's not necessarily obvious before you start. And secondly, I see my imaginative task is to put myself in the minds of those people. And I began to do that. Look at my own place. No one actually said to me, we went down every day to watch the water rising, and this is what we saw. They said we went down every day. I had to imagine what it was like going down to your house every day looking at what you were seeing. And I was looking at my own garden. Where would the water be at the end of week 33 when it was rising about 15 centimetres a week by that time, or 20? There it is at the back fence. 3 days later, creeping up the back lawn. 3 days later, what's left of the daffodils are gone. 3 days later, the tomato patch is underwater. 3 days later, it's up to the door sill of the back door. 3 days later, it's in the fireplace. 3 days later, it's coming out the front door. I live on a steep block. 3 days later, the fruit tree in the back garden suddenly died. 3 days later, the water's rising and rising until the top of the stone wall, oblivion. And of course, the water has gone down several occasions. The first big drought, 1982, some people were too traumatized to go back there, but some did go back there. People said prayers in the ruins of the old church. And they had picnics in their old garden. And they found to their amazement some of the bulbs that left behind were actually growing again. And I've walked around my house imagining what would be the first to emerge. And what would I find? What would I find there? What had been left behind? Well, that's, I'm not saying it has to be the role of the imaginative historian, but it's something that's driven me all this time. I've had plenty of critics. I've hardly had a good review in years of all my books, but the social scientists get to and say, reads off on his another little trip again. However, you've got to have a thick skin to be a historian, to tell you what, writing imaginatively. But what I think is what I always try and do, and I don't have to try and do, it seems to quite easily, is put myself in the minds of the people who are having the experience. And that's the third role I have as a historian, to put myself driving the ring around those experiences and then trying to encapsulate the experience. Not generalise it and say this, all people feel the same about losing their houses, because they don't. I don't try and generalise and say this is the experience of that community at that particular time in front of that particular trauma, and my readers then can draw whatever conclusions they like from it. I try and just present the information as it is and let people draw their own conclusions. So, that's my love. Over to Sam.
One of the myths that's really interesting about the Orthodox historian, really those who really believe that they're not actually being imaginative, they actually are, except it's sort of a subterfuge, whereas people like Peter is being overtly imaginative, because we all know there's no such thing as value-free facts, because you choose what to put in or not to put in, or what to juxtapose and not to juxtapose. So, they are, despite their protestations to the reverse, are in fact being imaginative and, I don't want to say dishonest way, but to pretend that they're not actually engaging their own value systems and imagination is actually quite a myth, and thus we get into the history wars.
Well, thank you very much. And on that note, to say I've been looking at the past 2 years, my next book, which unfortunately I lost 80% of due to a hard drive crash last week. Almost a flood. Well, a flood of not being at home and taking for granted the value of technology. But I've been looking at the past 2 years about, I think everyone has a sense of the value of history, but I've been looking at the price of history. One basic example is the irony of English language. I'm a thief. I appropriate the English language, a language that has been used to suppress my culture. The irony of the Mabo decision was that, Mabo was won on incredible legal terminology, but it was... Actually, one of the big things that helped the Mabo decision was that non-Indigenous anthropologists went in and recorded the history of the Murray Islanders. And that is one of the reasons why it was won. I've had the joy of looking through my family histories, and I'd just like to read you a piece. It's a letter. It's the end of a letter to the Protectorate of Aborigines about one of my earliest recorded ancestors who was moved to Palm Island. And this was addressed to W. Robinson, Protector of Aborigines in Queensland. And it just gives you an extent. I mean, it sort of enforces why I think I'm a thief and why I'm a bit of a cad. But I would like to point out this Aboriginal is cunning, cheeky, treacherous, and a dangerous Aboriginal, and would not hesitate to use anything that he could get a hold of. So that's one of my earliest ancestors in a character reference from the Protectorate of Aborigines. And indeed, history has been such an important thing, as I said before, because I suppose as a young Australian, I'm still living recent history. But the fact that I've now become an enterprising Indigenous writer, I mean, you just have to look at the last sort of five winners of the Walkley Awards, the highest awards in journalism. They've cut their teeth on debunking Aboriginal leaders, on debunking Aboriginal issues. So history is so important to me because one day I could be cut down for the stuff I write. In reading that first poem to you, Midnight's Boxer, a bit of a sad epiphany. Yesterday morning, opened up the newspapers in Queensland, and this is an article from the Q Weekend. The Midnight's Boxers were, of course, were men in our community who couldn't get permission to join Olympic teams. They couldn't get permission to travel from the Protectorate of Aborigines. They made their entire yearly income from the Jimmy Sharman's boxing tents. This is from an article yesterday's Q Weekend about the homeless situation of the homeless in Brisbane. This is one of the men one of the people that the journalist found. And he's interviewing an Aboriginal woman on the street, and she points to a man sleeping in a gutter. "You know who this is?" she asks. "That's Adrian Blair." In 1964, Sherberg boxing champion Adrian Blair, boxer Frank Robertson, basketballer Michael Armat, became Australia's first Indigenous Olympians competing at the Tokyo Games. This man, gaunt and weary, with a red cask winestone on his beard, is a member of the Aboriginal and Islander Sports Hall of Fame. Sweet and personable, he offers a hand for a shaking. His daughter Margaret and her two small children rest by his side. "My dad is a legend," says Margaret. "He boxed for this country." Her eldest boy, a beautiful toddler who bounds around the grotto like a slippery featherweight, throws a series of shadow punches. "Legend," he sings. So the Midnight's Boxers, I mean, that poem that's been now translated into several languages and I've read it in several countries, these are sort of real people from my history. What I do is I basically write textual postcards on what I've been taught about. The second poem I read, Last Exit to Brisbane, it's now been turned into a documentary by, I'll have to say, the director of this documentary is now my fiancé. Tried to make it a professional relationship, but I couldn't help falling in love with this beautiful artist. It was amazing when she heard that poem, and she wanted to learn more about the boundary in Brisbane. And she looked at the UBD and the broken line of the boundary streets. It wasn't up until about 1965 that our people wouldn't get pulled up by police. Black American servicemen who were on R&R from Vietnam. I mean, they went to the black pubs in West End because that's where their music was being played. And they'd constantly be pulled up by the Bjelke Petersen police force. What Helly couldn't get over was how much information was in the state archives, the maps, the documents about stopping our people from crossing that line. Crib Island, that poem I talked about, it it was sad as a kid. And now, I mean, there's not many of those old people left, but most of the people that lived on Crib Island were immigrants escaping the Holocaust, escaping World War II. They'd bought a cheap little block of dirt and built it up beautifully to suddenly find out one day that they're getting thrown off. So, yeah, the price of history. I'm exploring that quite heavily in my work now. I've grown up with a value of history, but the price of it. What worries me is that we live in a country now that has a real censorship on history. It's a bit subversive what I do, because now I'm studying in schools, I find I can really get to kids. If I can't change their parents' minds, I can change their minds. But what's so scary is I've been running these little workshops where I say, what's the capital of Australia? And they, Sydney. Someone finally says, Canberra. And, oh, that's great. Where's Homer Simpson go after work every night? And they'll go, most heaven. The scary thing is, I think, and one of the important things about my job and Peter's job and Mark's job is that we're being desensitised so much by media. People are no longer coming home and sitting around the dinner table at night and talking about their days off. They're getting in front of the TV. Kids know more about Springfield in The Simpsons than they know about their own backyard. So, yeah, well, anyway, that's my rant. And so from that quote, from that letter, the Protector of Aborigines, there is so much in the archives about my family. The crazy thing is, like, there's not that many Indigenous historians that are well published. So why would non-Indigenous historians, when they've got so much to go on, why would they make this stuff up? And what has sort of got me on my life about, you know, people like Windshuttle that talk about these made-up massacres. What did my people have to gain? And what did they have to compare a massacre to lie about it? And when you really, in my culture, when you lie about the death of someone, it really upsets the state of balance in nature. It upsets your state of balance mentally. So why do we make these things up? So it is important to me to write these textual postcards down to also give a bit of dignity to the people I write about, but also for the fact, you know, I am worried about getting pulled up. You're always getting shot down. When I won the 2005 Book of the Year, one journalist in The Australian said, oh, I stole it from Tim Winton. Well, yeah, Tim Winton's one of my heroes, but I don't know if I stole it from him. But you are always getting shot down, I think, as an Indigenous artist. And hopefully you can only persevere and hope that things will change in the future. Anyway, thank you very much.
Yeah, the Aboriginal sort of dilemma thing is, you know, is you, if you're successful, it's because you're an Aboriginal and you've got special treatment, and if you're not, if you fail, it's because you're an Aboriginal and you don't know how to do it. So it's sort of a kind of an interesting little dilemma that you particularly experience in institutions. Or if you do succeed, it's because it's the white in you. Not the black. I mean, I'm sure we've heard all these things. So it's still, what's interesting about it, it still persists. It's really important for people like Sam and Peter, who I think what probably came out, and I'll put this to them, is by doing history, either in the poetic form or the dialogue form, and does it enable you both, for example, to talk about the emotive quality of history as we know it, in a more safe, less confrontational way? Is it, you know, is there something about telling history in the way you two guys tell history that enables you to get a message out?
Yeah, I hope I'm not a polemicist too much, although some people accuse me of being that. And I'm always aware of who I'm writing for, whether you're trying to write to an academic audience or a general informed readership, which is what publishers like these days. But you've always got to realise there are a good many people that you'll never convince. I actually had a debate with Keith Windshuttle a couple of weeks ago on the Stolen Generations, and he had several arguments to try and demonstrate I was wrong. One was, well, if the state government wanted to take all the children away, how come they're building so many schools on reserves? He asked me. And secondly, well, in the annual reports of the Protection Board in 1926, New South Wales Protection Board, 1926 and 1945 or so, there were instances of the board in its annual report saying we don't intend to take children away. And I replied as best I could on that. There are kind of obvious answers in the first one. Well, the schools were being built at the time before the removal policy was really underway. The schools were built up to about 1910. I mean, you know, it's not a mystery. But I could see that, you know, we had a cup of coffee afterwards, had a yarn with him, but I could realise, I could see that I really wasn't making any headway at all. And sometimes one can't convince. But if I'm talking to a mob of students, I think my duty is to problematise the issue. You know, Aboriginal mothers did sometimes sign their children away. Well, let's face it, they did. And let's talk about why. What sort of pressures were they under that they won't do that? Why weren't there any relatives around who could take the kids? Okay, because, you know, this is what history is about, looking at the complication and the problems. But I'll choose my audience to say that, and if I'm talking on to Alice Springs Radio, well, I'm not going to come up with that argument, because that just complicates issues the other way, because I'm trying to convince people there that we do have an issue with the stolen generations that needs very, very serious addressing. And so I'm not going to introduce qualifications there. I'll probably give a list of children whom I know were taken away from Alice Springs and come up with some quotations from various chief protectors and other people in the Northern Territory to the effect that we are taking large numbers of children away because we think it's a good thing to do so. So we all of us choose our messages, and I don't know whether Sam, all of us historians choose our messages all the time, depending on whom we're talking to. Whether Sam does that or not, I'll be interested to find out, so we should ask him.
Yeah, I don't try to be confrontational in my work, but I do find that through my poetry, I mean, unfortunately, with poetry, you're speaking to the converted, I find, in most audiences. And I hate walking into Borders and find my book next to Maxie Walker's cricket yarns in the Australiana section. But it does happen. What I try to do is, like, paint pictures and encourage people through reading my poetry to paint their own pictures of recollections of the past. I think it's something I did think about when I was listening to Peter talk was the fires that just ravaged through California. Every person they interviewed talked about, you know, the most prized possession they lost were their wedding photos or their family photos in a fire. And my mum has always said, oh, look, if the house burns down, you know, I'll be throwing you kids out and then the photos after that. So I look at my poetry is like the same sort of thing, they're textual photographs. I said, whether or not that sinks in, I find mostly at writers' festivals and events like this, I'm speaking to the converted. So I'm not sure how my poetry, especially the poetry I write, I'm still looking at ways to get across to the wider populace. I mean, the good thing is now that with the HSC, I'm speaking to school kids in New South Wales all the time, they get so emotionally charged about my work. They go nuts over it. I can't believe this happened in my country. And they say, and they come out with things like, this is sick, you know, rah. They come up with all these terms. As I said, if I can't get through to their parents, I'm getting through the next generation of voters who maybe will think twice. And I think that, definitely with HSC, it's a subversive way, I suppose. It's a conservative government that brought in, like, putting writers into schools. So, in a way, I'm sort of...
Oh, you're just writers in general, really.
Getting in there. At least one group that I am getting through is kids who, you know, helping develop their own sort of little social conscience. As I said, Australia, to me, is still such a young country. As a writer, Peter and I are doing, one of our main jobs, I think, is helping strengthen the national identity through our work.
Which is interesting, isn't it, that the history they're getting the history that they don't know about, that they're now getting through poetry, which is very much kind of back to the beginning of the question. Anyway, I'm not supposed to be asking questions. You are.
The bit that you read, I presume that came from conversation with Doretta, was it?
No, poor old Doretta was a bit past it by the time I met her. But the scene is really based around the document which Doretta signed, which says, I give permission to take this child from Bomentry Lutanda because she's a fair-skinned child and I wish to not to associate with Aboriginal people, or words to that effect. And Doretta said to Joy, and I know this from Joy, that this form wasn't signed at the time. I've no reason to think that Doretta whatsoever was inclined to give Joy away to Lutanda because she used to come visit her all the time from Wallaga Lake after she found out where she was. And therefore that scene's been constructed around there using that document as a base and everything else sort of follows from it, knowing what Bomentry looks like and so on.
Yeah. No, thanks. That's the thing I found when you're... I mean, those stories, you know, I thought you probably had interviewed Doretta, but those stories of the pain of people who have gone through a thing like that, you can get that into you, you know, and then you can express it. It's the other side, the person sitting on the other side of the desk, which is a lot harder. Mm. How do you get that story? Because they're so reticent.
Yes, that's true. There's only one part where I have, and that's part... I've got to be very careful. I don't want to be sued by the home in question. There was... during the course of Joy's trial, they went to talk to all the people who'd been associated with Joy, both students, fellow students of Joy, and the staff. And one particular person, I won't name since this is going online, maintained very strongly in very, very strong language why Joy's moral character was so deficient. She was about 14 at the time, because one, her mother was a drunkard, two, she didn't want her, and three, she was an Aboriginal. And she made some extremely disparaging remarks about Aboriginality in general. Very, very familiar to Sam, I've no doubt, and certainly familiar to me growing up in the 1950s, as I did. Now, there were two young trainee solicitors who took the deposition down, didn't get the lady in question to sign it, and so the judge accepted all the written evidence from all the people in the home except that one. He said, well, it wasn't signed off, and they weren't properly trained interviewers and various other objections, and therefore I'm not going to admit this as evidence. I have admitted it to evidence because I've got no reason not to. So I don't have to follow legal rules. It sounds to me extremely reminiscent, I should say, of the 1950s. It's everything that I grew up with. And there were two young trainee lawyers who went on to become solicitors in the New South Wales Aboriginal Legal Service, and they both signed off on it themselves. And there were two of them, not just one. So I've used that as a conversation in one of the subsequent scenes in which they're debating whether they should get rid of Joy out of the home she was in, and I've used this as an evidence. Now, that puts them in a rather pejorative light, no doubt about it, and I'll be able to consult some lawyers about what to do. In general, I've never written this kind of fiction before, and I'm trying to work towards understatement rather than overstatement. I'm trying not to tell my audience readership what to think. And the only person I ever get inside the mind of, and I'm trying to be careful about this, is Joy herself. So I'm not trying to get in the mind of other people. And I'm trying to let my readers make up their own minds about things. So I haven't tried to get into the mind, apart from that instance I told you, I haven't tried to get in the minds of all sorts of other people who influenced Joy in the course of her life. So that's the answer.
No, that's very helpful. I mean, I've been in Canada, you see, and what I saw was that the staff of those institutions and the their former inmates have had a whole lot of dialogues across the country. And it's really brought a lot from the white people.
Yep.
But we're nowhere near that yet.
Mm. How true. Yeah.
Anyone else like to contribute to...
Thank you. This is a question directed to both Sam and Peter. I'm just interested in whether you see a sense of optimism or you feel a sense of optimism when you talk with the younger generation about a shared history.
Yeah,
and whether those, the sharing component is a little bit larger than perhaps it was when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. You go first?
Yeah, look, I'm constantly, week after week, jealous of those little suckers. I'd rather be, if I had my life over again, I'd rather be a school student in this generation because, and I find it, the weird thing is, it's the big exclusive schools in Sydney where the Packers and Murdochs send their kids. Those kids, the sad thing is that the money and the exclusiveness of school, I think, buys them more of a space to develop a social conscience. It's those kids that really take to me. And there's kids that actually apply to spend 5 minutes with me and show me their writing. And it's those kids who are really interested in Indigenous issues. So, yeah, always try to be optimistic. I don't want to come away from a school and have a parent ring up the school to say, oh, this writer you got in filled my, you know, he's making petrol bombs in the backyard and he's going down to Kirribilli House. I don't want to do that. I want them to, as I said, paint their own pictures with the pictures I create. And, you know, hey, if they decide to take up a cause when they leave school and they've developed their own social conscience, then, you know, that's a big plus. It's like putting a seed down. If it sprouts, it sprouts. But definitely, I mean, I've got two little boys. I do not want them to get this idea that they have to attack everything and tear everything down that's built around them. I'd rather them become respecting young men who, you know, if they choose to be activists like their grandfather, then, hey, that's a good thing. Yeah.
Hmm.
Kids are just so impressionable. Yeah. I think it's a stick of dynamite sometimes. You've got to treat it gently. Yeah.
Yeah, it's better, as you say, about kids in, you know, wealthy schools where they're the people who are going to have the power and the money and the voice. So there's, you know, it's very interesting that you say that. And it is about buying education enables them the space. So that's...
The funny thing, another thing I have noticed, though, it's the wealthy schools I find... There's still a form of segregation.
Yeah.
The Asian kids will sit on one side of the theatre and all the other kids will sit on the other side and it's mostly the Asian kids that fire me the difficult questions about being put down as a kid in school. So, there's still a bit of that harsh sort of schoolyard thing happening. But it's the non-Indigenous kids in the schools who come from really influential families that do ask me the really intrinsic questions about Indigenous culture. So,
Yes, I have to agree with that. In my book Belonging, I spent a bit of time talking to black and white kids on both sides, and it sounds a bit of a cliche to say, but it's certainly true that the ones who are at least responsive to what you might call the general mainstream currents of society were some girls from an exclusive boarding school in Sydney who all came from the country, who were completely unrepentant and unregenerate and unreconstructed. Frighteningly so. But most other kids I spoke to, of non-Aboriginal kids, were, much more receptive. On the other side, Jackie Huggins and I run a program called 7 Years On for the National Library, and we go and interview, about 80 young Indigenous people around the country, of whom one is Sam. We first spoke to him 7 years ago, and we return to them every 7 years to continue the story. And that is absolutely inspiring. You wouldn't believe, well, you would, I'm sure, the inspiration that Jackie and I draw from young people and not so young people whom we return to. We've been doing 15 years now, pretty well, who are so absolutely passionate. Indigenous people are absolutely passionate and so incredibly capable. And you just think back, and people like Joy, who had the same ability to spend a life as a drunk, you know, a drunk and a junkie. What wasted potential there has been in the past, but how exciting that things are going on at the moment, eh? You must find that as well.
Sadly enough, though, a lot of the high schools I go to of late, they have a session where the Indigenous kids can just come and spend time with me, and I don't get any kids turn up.
No, really?
None. They don't turn up. The last high school I went to, they ended up buying a crate of my books, so all the Indigenous kids turned up and got a book signed and then left. But I've gone to high schools in New South Wales with really big Indigenous populations, and the kids, it's not compulsory, so they don't turn up.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Well, I blame the media to an extent that most Indigenous speakers are only seen to be sort of, what's that word you were, polemicists?
Reconstructive?
They're only seen to be there's only snippets.
Yeah.
And they see most of our community leaders as people who are only speaking when they've got a gripe against things. So maybe, I don't know, maybe they think, I'm going to preach to them about pulling up your socks and that when, So that is one sad reflection, yeah.
Has anyone got a burnt? There's a burner. That's probably the last one, actually. Unless someone's really got something they have to get out.
Thank you.
I've got one fella, maybe one more.
Just one question to Sam. The books of poetry that you've published, have you ever found them in a library classified under English language and literature?
No. Always find them under Australiana or no, and it's still hard for Indigenous writers to sort of break into that literary
genre.
But yeah, you can only pray it'll get better. I mean, when Rabbit Proof Fence came out on, in the films, it had been out for at least a decade, and suddenly the publishing house had this big interest in it, and it covers had to be remade, and there had to be rewrites, and this and that. It's quite weird. Literary festivals, I think, up until a couple of years ago, they had a thing where you had to have a black poet that'd be on stage. You had to have someone who'd explode, and little bits of cinder, a black writer would sprinkle all over the audience. But now there is a really good generation of fresh Indigenous voices of all age groups coming up, and yeah, we are becoming a bit of a literary force, which is good. I no longer feel alone on the circuit. We have a Sydney writer, Anita High. She's now getting into chick lit, which, if I hear the word chick lit again, I'm going to kill someone. But anyway, it's a huge market, and she's breaking into it quite successfully. So yeah.
Yeah, she's the one who says concrete crews and Westfield Dreaming. I don't wear ochre on my skin. I wear Revlon. And no, I don't consult the sun to tell the time. Look at my Rolex. They're confidently, they're a bit black. Oh, sorry, one more. I gather if you've got to go, you would have gone by now. So there's one gentleman there who wants to say something, and then we should wrap up.
Yeah, I'm trying to put what you two are saying in the context of the wider society. And I wonder whether you do have the advantage, at least, of distance, because you can look back, whereas with what's going on under our noses at the moment is the destruction in the minds of Australians of the union movement. It happens every day during this campaign that's being waged. Every single day we hear of the evils of unionism. I wonder whether the people that are perpetrating that realise that their long service leave owes its origins to the union movement, whether they realise that equal pay owes its origins to the union movement, etc., etc., etc. And yet they get up there and are constantly destroying, alas, the sort of stuff that Windschuttle does, but it's coming out of the mouth of a man that's well known to all of us, who's trying to win yet another election, that the union movement is absolutely evil. And it just ain't so. Hmm. For those of us that know.
I think it's probably time. Thank you very much for that.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.